It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, these days, software is part of our lives 24/7. Powers your smartphone, social media, credit card transactions, the smart speaker you may be listening to right now, your fitness tracker, the brakes in your car. And as we've learned in the news lately, software is a major part of modern aviation. All of this software is written by computer programmers. The latest book by my guest this half hour dives into the world of computer programming to examine the people who work in it. Journalist Clive Thompson is the author of Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. He's a longtime contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, monthly columnist for Wired, also author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Clive Thompson, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Tell us more about the questions you set out to examine in this book.
Well, what I was really interested in was the question of who makes software and what are their kind of dreams and visions for what they're trying to do to the world. Because, you know, I think that everyone today who, you know, uses a phone and uses the internet definitely gets the idea that software has this massive impact on us, you know, ranging from how we order, you know, our food to how we order cars to how we learn about the world, you know, via apps like, you know, Facebook or Instagram. So they sort of get the idea, wow, this stuff is important. But they have really no idea, you know, who's making it and why those people are kind of picking the companies they want to found or picking the challenges they want to conquer. And I really wanted to give people a sort of a picture of who are these folks that are doing this? How did they get into it? What makes them tick?
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about the people in just a moment, but I think a lot of us, of course, don't have any idea or have misconceptions about what the work is like, the bricklaying, so to speak. What is the work of coding? What are programmers doing most of the time?
Yeah, well, programming is, you know, to put it simply, just the art of giving instructions to computers line by line, very meticulously, very carefully, to tell them exactly what to do to accomplish a task. And you have to be incredibly precise and incredibly literal. You know, like if you said to me, Clive, go get me a cup of coffee, you know, I'm a human. I know how to do that. That's all you need to tell me. If you're trying to tell a computer, go get a cup of coffee, you have to say things like, you know, you have to, like, you know, grab the coffee mug in exactly this format, put it in exactly this place, pour this exact amount in. It's incredibly painstaking work. So what coders are really doing all day long is that they're sitting there thinking about what is this task they're trying to, you know, do. Like maybe they're trying to figure out how to scrape your financial information and send it to you in a text message when you ask for it. Well, you know, they have to break that down into such tiny little steps, and then they have to try and start putting them together in a sequence. And frankly, a lot of what they're doing is staring at stuff that isn't working, because it's really hard to do, because you have to be so precise. There's so many things that can go wrong that honestly, 99% of the time, they're just running their code and it's not working and they're trying to figure out why. So the thing I learned that was really interesting that I didn't really expect, which is that one of the greatest traits of programmers is that they are amazingly good at dealing with frustration, because I swear to God, 99% of the time, what they're doing is trying to run a piece of code that they just wrote, and it's not working, and they've got to figure out why. So they're sitting there, running their hands through their hair, you know, stroking their chin, and staring at something that's not working. That is what, honestly, a lot of computer programming actually is.
Right.
Interesting.
And you describe it in the book as endless hours of brutal, grinding frustration. And an example that struck me makes it very clear to anyone, that, you know, this hand-wringing, rubbing your hair, rubbing your face, getting up, walking around, all to maybe over the course of hours discover that a semicolon or a period is missing in lines of code.
Oh, yeah, I know. And I've done this myself. Like, I mean, I started doing some programming because I wanted to, you know, learn what the experience was like myself so that I could talk to people a little more in depth. And I'll tell you, you know, one of the craziest things is how many of these errors come down to a bracket that is in the wrong place or was sort of left out, or a slightly misspelled variable. Instead of cars, you put car. And some of these things can really become consequential. There is this there's a story that I tell in the book of Amazon, you know, which runs these very big web services that power a lot of some of the biggest internet companies. So, you know, Twitter or Trello, which is some people use to help organize their tasks. You know, these are companies that they run some of their code runs on these Amazon servers. They rent time on these Amazon servers. And an Amazon employee was doing an update, just a regular update of code, and made a one-character mistake, like a single semicolon, and it brought down, like, the entire East Coast of their servers to 3 hours, right? Oh. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, millions and millions of customers unable to access Twitter, unable to access Trello, unable to access all these things for 3 hours because a single semicolon was out of place. That's what coding is like.
Talk about the type of people that this type of work attracts. It's such amazing work, such precise work. It really attracts a certain type of people, and it then shapes them, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, who gets attracted to this? Well, in one sense, I think it's some of the stuff you would expect. It's people who are very good at thinking logically. They like solving puzzles. They like breaking things, complicated things down into smaller pieces so they can think about them and solve it. They're also very meticulous, right? I mean, if you're going to do this, you have to really have an eye for detail. There's this famous coder from the 1960s, Mary Ellen Wilkes, who told me that she's the type of person who, when she walks into a room, immediately notices if a poster is hanging, like, at a 2-degree wrong angle and rushes over to fix it, right? You know, they're just precision-minded folks, and that carries over into the rest of their lives. They're often extremely precise in the way they talk. They're often extremely precise in the way they write. Sometimes I found a lot of coders are extremely good writers because that ethic of being incredibly precise carries over into every other part of their life, right? So precision, logic, but definitely, here's the thing. There's a really a creative edge to this, right? You know, there's a real delight and joy in when you finally get that code working. You know, there's this deep frustration with all the errors. But when it finally gets working and it's doing exactly what you told it to, there is this feeling of mastery and creativity that you've created this, like, a little artificial life form, this little robot, this little Frankenstein that's going to go off and do your bidding. That is unbelievably pleasant. That is the sort of narcotic jolt that keeps them going over and over again through that frustration, because it's so much fun to have that creative moment. And so I find there's an aspect of what they do and their joy in this that's very creative. It's like an artist creating, you know, an artwork, or you know, the joy that, like, you know, a craft person might have in, you know, if they're doing woodcraft and creating this thing that then you can show off to the world. That's very strong there. It's really interesting. It's actually the joy that keeps them in the game, even if there's other things hassling them or bothering them about it.
Well, the pay these days has to keep them in the game as well, right, Clive?
That's right. Oh my goodness, right. I mean, this is some of the most lucrative work, you know, you can get. Certainly, you know, there's all these stories of, you know, you go to Silicon Valley and, you know, become a millionaire. But even if you don't do that, like, even if you were just, you know, I'm staying in my town here. I'm in, you know, I'm in Des Moines. I'm in, you know, Chicago. I'm in Atlanta. You know, there is coding work everywhere now, and it is it's extremely interesting work. It's very intellectually challenging. It's very well paid. It's something I was sort of surprised to find is that, you know, we think of coding as this thing that happens in the West Coast, California, Silicon Valley, but that's only 8% of all coding jobs in the United States. The other 92% are all over the place. In every town of any size, there are coders.
Clive Thompson is my guest, if you've just joined us, a journalist and author of the new book, Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. He's a longtime contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Also, perhaps you've seen his monthly column for Wired. And for this book, he He got into coding culture, interviewed a whole spectrum of coders for this book. It's really a fascinating book to check out. So let's pivot a little bit, if we could, Clive, to talk about your writing on the history of coding, because I was fascinated, and I think this is not well known. You mentioned Mary Ellen Wilkes a few moments ago, that when coding started, it didn't have the status or the pay that it does today, and women were some of the earliest pioneers here, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, here's the funny thing about coding. Like right now, I think you're exactly right. People see it as a mostly a guy thing, and that's because it's true. Demographically, you know, only like about one quarter of all the coders in the United States are women. But in the very early days, the percentage was higher than that, because you know, you have to sort of get your mind back in what coding was like in the 1950s and early 60s. And one of the things is that it wasn't yet a high status profession, right? The back then, the computers were the size of a room, you know, these great big devices. And the glory, and often the higher pay, was in making the hardware. That was seen as kind of a manly task. And so all the men gravitated towards actually physically building the machines. Once it was built, you had to get someone to issue the instructions to it to, you know, quote-unquote program it. But that was sort of seen as a secondary task. It didn't seem very important to them. And so what that meant is that, you know, they would put out a call for, we need people to be programmers. And two things. One is that, you know, they would kind of hire anyone who expressed an interest who was kind of good at logic puzzles, because there was no computer science degrees yet. Like, there wasn't even a course you could take. No one knew how to do it. So everyone was just sort of making it up and learning on the job. And so that woman, Mary Ellen Wilkes, you know, she was a kid going to college in the 50s. She wanted to be a trial lawyer. Like, that was her dream, you know, trial law in front of the judge. But everyone told her, and they were right, you know, this is just too sexist an industry in the 50s. They are not going to let you be a trial lawyer. If you're lucky, you'll get to be, you know, a legal secretary or something like that. And so she gave up on her dream of trial law and said, well, what else can I do with my life that's interesting, that uses my very logical, you know, meticulous mind? And she'd heard about computers. So she, on the day she graduates, she tells her parents to pick her up in their car, drive her over to MIT, and she walks right in to the employment office and says, I hear you've got a computer. Do you need any programmers? And they looked at her and they said, yeah, sure, we need programmers. You know, and they took her into a room and gave her a kind of a logic puzzle test, and she passed it. And they're like, all right, you're hired. So that's how you got to be a coder back then, right? The door was really open, and a lot of the people that walked in were women. So this carried on for, you know, a good 10 or 15 years. A lot of the people that wrote some of the early computer languages that became very influential were women, people like Grace Hopper, who was one of the people instrumental in writing a language called COBOL. It was one of the first business languages, still being used 40 years later. Like, probably over two-thirds of every bank ATM transaction you do runs on COBOL code. So a language that she invented, she helped invent 30, 40 years ago, is still being used. So women were some of the towering pioneers in those first decades. Very interesting.
Very interesting history you give here. And we only have about, I don't know, 10 or so minutes left, but take us up to the point where, I guess, this becomes high status. We have that breakthrough in the 80s, the Apple I computer, amateurs get into the game. And then what? Men pull it away from women, so to speak, in a certain sense.
Yeah. I mean, basically, so what happened is, so over the 70s, you know, late 60s and 70s, coding starts to become much more valuable, right? Like, companies are realizing, wow, we're relying on this code now to process our payroll, to do data analysis, to do sales tracking. And so they start kind of going, okay, we need to hire people who we can, you know, who are coders, who might eventually ascend to become management, like vice president. Back in the 70s and early 80s, that meant they were hiring men, because there was no way they were going to hire a young female coder and then bring her up to the C-suite. They did not think it was a good idea to have women in charge of men. So you started seeing them hiring specifically for a type. They wanted guys. And there was even like weird structural things. Like, I heard all these wild stories. you know, a lot of companies back then in the late 60s and 70s, they had rules saying women could not be on the premises past dinner time, right? Because it was sort of unseemly to have young single women working, you know, late at night on projects along with married men. And so you could be an amazing female coder and doing your great work, and then here comes the evening shift when all the coders are going to crack down, burn the midnight oil, and get stuff done till 2 a.m, and you can't be there, right?
Wow.
So all these weird things that we sort of forgot were very common in the much more sexist 70s really started driving women out of that field. Frankly, if they had a child, by law in places like Massachusetts, they had to leave their job. Like, you literally could not legally be employed if you had kids and you're a woman, because you were supposed to be home looking after them. So all these things came along and started taking these women who'd been massive pioneers in coding and just saying, you know, out the door, right? It was a really interesting shift, and it's quite a tragedy for the industry, because it drove away all this talent, right? All these people who were manifestly amazing at doing this got sort of booted out the door. So, of course, 20 years later, by the 90s, by the aughts, you know, it just seems sort of normal to the hiring managers, to the employers, to the CEOs, the coders are mostly guys, because it's kind of been that way for 15 years. And so when they think, well, who should we hire? Their mind immediately goes to, hey, we should hire some, you know, sort of a young guy who's staring at his shoes. That's what a coder looks like. Like, it sort of became that Hollywood trope became like part of the central casting of the people doing the hiring.
Journalist Clive Thompson, my guest. A few more minutes with him today. Coders is his book, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. I wanted to jump to social media, the criticisms of it today, the criticisms of the outsized influence it has on our lives, our health, privacy issues, the role in the workplace, the psychological effects we've talked about on this program. We talked about the monoculture of men. Could this bad stuff have been avoided with more thoughtful program design, without just white guys doing this?
I definitely think it would have helped, for sure. That's certainly what a lot of people told me when I talked to some of the early pioneers who were involved in building early social software. They said, you know, look, you know, we were involved in building, you know, Twitter and Facebook and communication tools and forums and discussion tools. And they were, you know, what one of them told me is, we were naive as F. I'm not going to say that word, the word on the radio, but basically he said, we did, you know, they didn't really, because they're a bunch of young guys, and I've been a young guy, so I know what this is like. They didn't have great insight into the experiences of people that were not like them. Young guys don't, we tend not to get as much abuse, you know, in public when we speak out and raise our voices, compared to women or compared to, you know, African Americans, Latinos, people of color. So, you know, they were sort of building things like Twitter and thinking, this is fun, you know, people be able to talk to each other, that's great. And it really was great, right? I mean, there's a lot of amazing things that came out of Twitter, Facebook, but they were not sort of anticipating the fact that there was also going to be abuse and harassment and attempts at, like, you know, serial disinformation, because, you know, that wasn't really part of their experience. So sometimes you think, wow, if you could rewind time and have, you know, a coding team, a design team that was, you know, a little more less of a monoculture, you know, that brought in people with different perspectives, they might have caught wind of the idea that they're going to wrestle with this stuff. They might have started trying to, you know, build tools for mitigating harassment, for mitigating abuse a few years earlier, and it might have blunted some of the problems that we've seen, you know.
Right.
This is all what-ifs, you know, 2020 hindsight.
So,
but definitely I think it's an argument that it's a good idea to have a few more heads at the table than happened with some of these early social media giants.
Clive, given all the valid criticisms of social media today, what do you suggest, or what did you hear from the coders you interviewed as perhaps remedies for the problems you've written about and we experience?
Well, there aren't any easy ones, is the first thing. But definitely some of the things people talked about are that it would be good if they could find some ways to move move away from the ad-supported models, right? Because at the moment, one of the problems all these large social networks face is that they make money off advertising. And that's all well and good. But what it tends to do is incentivize them to promote the most kind of hysterical or emotional posts for everyone to look at. Because that's kind of the mesmerizing car crash stuff that gets you staring at it. And they want you staring at it because they're selling ads, right? Mm-hmm. So once you've got something that's purely ad-supported, it creates a lot of incentives to write the code that that sort of elevates, you know, hysterical stuff and doesn't instead elevate, you know, the stuff that's maybe more reasoned or, you know, more thoughtful or gets you to sort of scratch your chin and think a little bit more. So some of the thinking about some ways to make these profitable enterprises without relying on ads would be one big step that would help them step back from some of these kind of algorithms they've written that promote crazy stuff. That would be one good thing. It's possible that, you know, some people have talked about, you know, the questions of whether or not these companies are monopolies, whether they should be broken into smaller pieces, and whether that would help. So you'd actually have real competition. At the moment, something like YouTube, something like Facebook, something like Twitter, they effectively have no real competition, right? I mean, right. They technically speaking, you could move to something else, but there's nothing else to move to. So that's a trickier proposition. I don't really know what that would look like, but people talk about that. Those are some of the things people talk about.
Clive Thompson, in the last minute we have, I have to ask you about the big sci-fi threat that is in movies that we talk about, the threat that someday AI and artificial intelligence surpasses us humans in general intelligence, becomes super intelligent, this new super intelligence becomes powerful, difficult to control. What do coders think about that?
Yeah. I will tell you, I wondered about that too. I asked that question to some of the top AI designers on the planet, people at Google, you know, people at Baidu in China. And here's what I'll tell you. I don't think you have to worry too much, because the higher you get, the more deeply enmeshed you are in actually having to build the stuff, the more you know how hard it is to truly replicate human intelligence. So a lot of them would say, this does not keep me awake at all. They are much more worried about near-term things, like would it be possible to create AI that could, you know, automate some task that would put a lot of people out of work. They're like, now that is something that you should worry about.
Okay.
But the idea that it's going to sort of achieve self-awareness, they say that's so many decades in the future, and one quarter of them in a poll said never. So I don't think you need to let that one keep you awake at night.
Okay, we won't then. Journalist Clive Thompson, the author of Coders, The Making of a New Tribe, The Remake and the Remaking of the World. Fascinating book. Clive, thank you for this conversation.
I had a great time.
After a short break, we'll talk about something called hospital delirium. Patients who begin to see or hear things that aren't there, they experience delusions or extreme confusion. Maybe you've had such an experience during a hospital stay. You can share it when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.